Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We've got an in-studio performance coming up from the Dum Dum Girls. There's actually nothing dumb about them. Their band name is a very knowing reference to an old Iggy Pop song called Dum Dum Boys. We'll hear from the Dum Dum Girls, but we'll also continue our month-long look back at the summer of 94, including an installment of our series That Was a Hit, a series about unexpected and unexplainable pop chart success. So we'll look back at an unlikely hit from that summer 20 years ago. Actually, there were a couple of unlikely hits that summer. One of them came from a dorky group of California kids who were singing, strangely enough, about Buddy Holly and Mary Tyler Moore. So, as our look back at the summer of 94 continues, we'll welcome to the Soundcheck studio the Brooklyn-based comedian Hari Kondabolu. He just released his first comedy album called Waiting for 2042, and on it, Hari pokes fun at some serious topics, from race to wealth to sexuality to this band, Weezer.
Now, my band was Weezer, right? I was obsessed with Weezer from 94 to 2000. I'm an old-school Weezer fan, blue album, Pinkerton, right? There's some Weezer geezers here, right? Like, first wave Weezer fan. I was obsessed with that band, 94 to 2000. Remember, this was the era of 14.4/28.8 internet connection. So if you wanted to download a 4-megabyte file, that was like a weekend, right? So I'd hear about a rare Weezer song that they made in their kitchen in 1992 called Let's Sew Our Pants Together, and I would prevent my parents from picking up the phone all weekend just to find out that I had downloaded a mislabeled Fountains of Wayne track, right? That's how Hari Kondabolu spent his youth.
Right. Hari Kondabolu did spend his youth listening to Weezer, including, of course, the band's self-titled debut, the so-called Blue Album, which turns 20 years old this year. And Hari joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is actually one of the greatest things I've ever done. Talking about Weezer is something I don't get to do enough of. Album, actually, it's been 20 years. It was released on May 10th, 1994. I know that because my first screen name on AOL Instant Messenger, the first one I really cared about, was Jonas594, because the first track on Weezer's debut album was My Name is Jonas.
Right.
And they released it May 1994.
So, but it seems like over the years, your relationship with Weezer has grown complicated.
Yes.
Why?
I feel like the Blue Album and Pinkerton are masterpieces. They're just incredible records, the first two releases. And then they disappeared for a while, and you know the talk has always been Rivers was so disappointed by how
That's
poorly...
That's Rivers Cuomo, the frontman.
Of Weezer, was so disappointed by the reviews of Pinkerton, the fact that the sales weren't that great. Now, I mean, it's aged really well, but I think he was so upset about that, he kind of just stopped. He went back to Harvard to finish school, and there was, I think there was rumors that one of his legs was bigger than his other legs, so he had to have surgery, too. I've done a lot of research on this. And in that time away, there was just a lot of hype because the internet was kind of surging along with Weezer's disappearance, right? So people were like, my early experiences on the internet was looking up Weezer fan pages and trying to get information. Where are they? When are they coming back? Like, that's how I knew about the leg thing. Like, I was obsessed with that band to such a degree where, like, and there's a lot of us who were the same way, where we found every old bootleg, like, every old press photo, everything. We tried to know everything about this band. So I think there's just a lot of pressure for that third album when it finally came out to be unbelievable. In that time period, Matt Sharp, the original bassist, left.
Right.
Mikey Welsh, now deceased, had taken over. Like, there's a lot of pressure on that record, and I hated it. And so many of us hated that Green Album. There were some fans who were still with them are like, oh, just a little different. It was like 22 minutes or 27 minutes or something. It was absurd. And then Maladroit came out, and that was disappointing. And then four, five, six records in a row after that. Just bad, 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 bad. Like, I can't support it.
And yet, Hari, as you know, listening to your record, Waiting for 2042, you do admit to going to a Latter-day Weezer concert.
Yes.
And having a somewhat unusual experience there.
I'm the creepy old dude at a Weezer concert at 28. That's when I realized I'm not the creepy old dude in this situation. Weezer are the creepy old dudes in this situation. They are 40-year-old men who are making music that somehow teenagers can relate to. How does that make any sense? Life is hard. Girls don't like me. And high school's weird. Of course it's weird. You're 40. What are you talking about? Imagine if my whole act was writing jokes that high school students could relate to. Wouldn't that be weird if I walked out on stage and I was like, homeroom? What's the deal with homeroom? We're at school right now. Shouldn't it be not homeroom? I'm relating.
So their fans are still 14 years old.
I think it's changed a bit recently, but as of 2 or 3 years ago, it was very awkward. And it was strange because I felt like with their early music, I was a teenager listening to music being made by like dudes in their like mid-20s talking about their experiences, and it was so exciting, and they were so self-deprecatory and funny, and there's such cleverness and earnestness on those records. And then, you know, going back, you know, the Green Album on, all of a sudden it felt like, I'm too old for this. This isn't for me, but they're older too. And how are they making music that like I cannot relate to as a 20-something or at that point, 18, 19-year-old?
So there's a Green Album by Weezer. More recently, there's a Red Album. But it all begins with the Blue Album.
Yes.
The first album, which comes out 20 years ago, that summer of 94. Buddy Holly was everywhere.
What's with this home?
The Sweater Song.
Right.
Know me if you want to destroy my sweater. Hold this thread as I walk you.
By the way, Hari, I now hate you because I have all of these songs now cycling through my head again.
Oh,
I mean,
wonderful.
They were just, you know, you couldn't avoid them in the summer of 94. But the one that you've chosen to start us off with is Say It Ain't So.
Yes.
Why?
I mean, Buddy Holly was the first one that got me hooked because that music video was incredible. The Happy Days inspired music video, which also came in the Windows 94 packet, if you remember. It had a DVD. So everyone just kept watching that video over and over again because how much media did you have at that point? And I liked them. They were kind of like, oh, that's a funny song, funny band.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing Weezer play Say It Ain't So on Letterman in 95. And I already liked them, but after that, I was they were so weird. Just Rivers' pants were too big. That's, again, before I found out about the leg thing. And, and like, they all looked so awkward, and they were singing with such heart, and I just fell in love with that band. I was, like, 11 or 12 at the time, and I stayed up late. My parents didn't know I was up, and I was watching Weezer on Letterman, and it was weird. Like, I was on Letterman for the first time a few months ago, and that was the first thing I thought about. I was like, I saw Weezer on Letterman in 95, and now I'm on Letterman.
Right, so. Slightly different show, different network, but
right.
same guy. Hari Kondabolu, the Brooklyn-based comedian, is here with us on Soundcheck, talking about that summer of 94 and his long-standing obsession with this album by the band Weezer.
Somebody's hiding, it's drowning my icebox. Somebody's cold one, it's giving me chills. Guess I'll just close my eyes. Oh yeah.
Say it ain't so.
Just a little bit from Weezer's self-titled debut album, which has come to be nicknamed the Blue Album. And that was the third of the three big singles, Say It Ain't So. We're speaking with Hari Kondabolu, the Brooklyn-based comedian. His new album is called Waiting for 2042. It's out now on the record label Kill Rock Stars. Hari also co-hosts the untitled Kondabolu Brothers podcast with his brother Ashok, formerly of the group Das Racist, and alumni of Soundcheck as well. How did you guys... Is Ashok also a Weezer fan? Would he have been the same in that sweet spot age-wise?
No, he was listening to B.I.G. at that point.
Really?
Yeah, we kind of... We had, like... You know, I mean, I grew up in New York, so I listened to hip-hop,
too. Where in New York?
In Queens. Yeah.
Where in Queens?
At that point, started in Jackson Heights, then we moved to Floral Park, Queens, and then Jamaica after that. But, like, Floral Park is kind of the neighborhood we really grew up in and where we would be listening to this. It was great. It was funny just right now listening to Say It Ain't So. I actually got my high school English teacher, my senior year, I got her to let me read the lyrics in class and analyze them, and I passed out the lyrics to all my classmates, and it's not that hard to analyze, really.
But what a Weezer nerdy thing to do.
Yeah, actually, yes. Analyzing lyrics, like, flip on the telly, wrestle with Jimmy. Who is this Jimmy? Exactly. No, it was, I was really obsessed with everything they had done at that point.
Do you still have that paper?
Oh, God, I wish I could find it. My God, I would totally put that online. Yeah. No, I'm just, they were so perfect. I mean, just everything about, like, falling in love, falling out of love. I mean, just how silly the lyrics could be. And at the same time, like, how thoughtful, too. My God.
So your brother Ashok is listening to Notorious B.I.G.'s first record, same summer.
Yeah, same summer.
You're listening to Weezer. Yeah. Is he beating the crap out of you?
I mean, it's funny. There was always a bit of a schism there. But, like, and I think I've grown to very much appreciate B.I.G., and I don't know how he feels about Weezer still, to be honest with you. But no, I mean, that's what makes that summer amazing. There was such a wide range of stuff, and people were listening to both.
Right. And people were watching the videos. You know, we mentioned Buddy Holly and the Sweater Song, the first two singles. Spike Jonze did both of those videos.
Right.
Same summer, he did Sabotage for the Beastie Boys.
Right.
So summer of 94, that's like the launching pad for Spike Jonze's career as
MTV
a filmmaker.
MTV was still huge, and, like, music videos were still really important, and, like, they were great videos.
So there were the three singles, but then you wanted to talk about one of the less appreciated tracks on the Weezer record.
I think The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, which is track three, which might not mean anything to any younger people who just download random things on the internet, but we had to listen to them in order or we had to skip them manually. The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, I think, is a fantastic song. And I love it also because it comes after track two, No One Else. And in No One Else, he's being completely sexist. Like, I want a girl who will talk to no one else, who puts her makeup on the shelf. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so awful to this woman that he's talking about. And track three, The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, is about the woman leaving him. And it's justice. You hear justice on the album. Like, this is what happens when you're sexist. She will leave and she should leave. And so in addition to the song just being amazing, I think I love that little bit of justice in it.
This is the song, The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, from Weezer's Blue Album.
The world has turned and left me here, just where I was before you appeared. And in your place, an empty space has filled the void behind my face. I just made love with your sweet memory 1,000 times in my head.
Song is The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, from the band Weezer, from their Summer of 94 record, which was also called Weezer, though everybody calls it the Blue Album. And 20 years later, the Brooklyn-based comedian Hari Kondabolu is still going, sifting through the lyrics, parsing the meanings and all of that. So you find social justice in this song.
In the track 2 to 3, yes. Yeah. I see something fair about that. She should have left him. Good for her.
So how did you come to Weezer? Was it through the radio play or was it through the nascent internet?
I think it was the music video, first of all. The music videos were played constantly, especially that Buddy Holly clip. So I think that was definitely, I'm from that generation that would have fallen in love with the band initially from the visual and then gotten more into it through the radio play and seeing various clips. I mean, and the internet really kind of solidified my obsession, but it didn't first get me into it, as opposed to now where a lot of people listen to the internet or get referred something or download an MP3 and then they're hooked. You know, it's different.
We were mentioning a moment ago your brother Ashok, you know, who went on to co-found Das Racist. So he was listening to Biggie Smalls, and we can see how the Notorious B.I.G. record of that summer might have been a gateway for him into something he eventually ended up doing professionally.
Possibly, yeah.
For you, was Weezer a dead end, or was it a gateway? What was it a gateway to for you?
I mean, there was something so silly about it, you know, because I had friends who listened to the Cranberries, and like, you know, I was sensitive, maybe not that sensitive at the time, and I had friends who listened to Green Day, and sometimes Green Day could be funny and kind of quirky, but they were also a little more blunt.
Right.
I liked like the cleverness and the silliness of this band. I mean, it fit my personality, and I think it solidified me as a person. I think especially Weezer fans at that time or the people that stuck with that band, you know, I feel like there is a certain type. There is a certain nerdiness about it. There is a certain silliness. There's a certain type of like, I want to be in the mosh pit, but I don't want to get hurt. I mean, there's a lot of us who are afraid to hurt each other. So, yeah, I mean, I'm of that ilk. Yeah.
Well, you know, listening to the Blue Album back, you know, 20 years ago when it first came out, you know, you were rewarded at the end of the album with an epic track. Because you know, a lot of the Weezer songs, they didn't overstay their welcome.
No.
Only in Dreams is a little different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very long. It starts out really slow, and then it builds. And it really, like, even back then before I really understood sex, I thought this, you know, was, oh, is this supposed to be an orgasm? I think this is an orgasm. I count Only in Dreams, the last Weezer track of the first album, as my first sexual experience. I think it was, though it slowly builds and there's a tension and then all of a sudden it just gets really fast and loud like fireworks and then all of a sudden it slowly goes back down and there's cuddling at the end. I think it's perfect. It's perfect.
It's the post-punk version of Wagner's Liebestode from Tristan and Isolde.
Oh, God, I wish you said that in 1994, and I wish that was in press kits nationwide. That's amazing. That's amazing.
Let's hear a little bit from the song Only in Dreams by Weezer. So that is a moment from the song Only in Dreams from the Weezer album called Weezer, but known to its fans as the Blue Album. It came out 20 years ago in that summer of 1994, and Hari, the album would eventually go triple platinum.
Mm.
How does it stand the test of 20 years passing? How does it sound today?
Still amazing. Still absolutely from the opening of My Name is Jonas to the end of Only in Dreams, it's great. And there's still songs on there that are underappreciated. I mean, Surf Wax America, In the Garage, like, it totally stands the test of time. And as does Pinkerton,
Is the follow-up record.
From
1996. 96, yeah.
But, yeah, certainly, I still think it's great, and I would love I would love to be able to go back in time. This is the closest I probably will get.
Hari Kondabolu is waiting for 2042. That's the name of his new album. It's on the Kill Rockstars record label. And Hari and his brother Ashok, formerly of the group Des Racist, when the mood strikes them, they co-host the untitled Kondabolu Brothers podcast. Has the mood struck you lately?
We have a couple in the tank, but we haven't actually edited them yet. But we're terribly inconsistent. But I hear that the podcast is good enough for people to keep downloading them, even though we're terrible about it. I might be waiting for 2042, but I'm longing for 1994.
Hari Kondabolu, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for all you've shown us. This is how we feel. Come sit next to me, pour yourself some tea. Just like grandma made when couldn't find sleep. Things were better then, once but never again. We've all left the den and tight by it. Choo-choo train left right on time. A ticket cost.
That's the track that kicks off the Blue Album by Weezer and inspired Hari Kondabolu's first screen name, as we just heard. It's called My Name is Jonas. We want to hear from you. What did you think of Weezer back in 1994? And did your opinion change over time? Post a comment at soundcheck.org or leave us a message, 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612, and you may find your voicemail on the radio. Our retrospective on the summer of 94 continues in a moment with a look back at a sleeper hit from Warren G and Nate Dogg. And then later we'll get back to the present day with an in-studio performance from Dum Dum Girls. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time now for another installment of our occasional series about puzzling chart success.
That was a hit.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
And as part of our month-long retrospective about music from the summer of 94, we turn to a hit from rapper and producer Warren G, one that featured the rapper and singer Nate Dogg. I'm talking, of course, about Regulate.
16 in the clip and one in the hole. Nate Dogg is about to make some bodies turn cold. Now they dropping and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate.
Regulate from Warren G and Nate Dogg. That was a hit in the summer of 94. Chris Malanfi, pop chart analyst, contributor to NPR Music and Slate, back with us on Soundcheck. Why is this? I mean, you could hear why that would be a hit. Why
so
are we talking
smooth.
About this in this context?
It's so smooth. Let's see. Why are we talking about this? Because it was a number two hit in the summer of 1994, because it is arguably the first sort of yacht rock hip hop hit. And we'll talk about why in a bit when we talk about the basis.
Let's describe our term, define our terms
first.
Fair
enough.
Yacht rock.
So yacht rock is a term that was coined actually just in the last decade, in the 2000s, by a bunch of guys in California who put together a video series, hilarious video series, by the way. Folks, if you haven't watched it, you're in for a treat. It's really, really funny, in which they talk about this moment at the end of the 1970s and early 80s when a coterie of California-based studio musicians were all playing on each other's records. And they called it yacht rock because a handful of the songs had a nautical theme. Think of Sailing by Christopher Cross or some of the hits by Loggins and Messina. But like, more importantly, the music was extremely smooth. And an omnipresent vocalist on many of these hits was Michael McDonald.
Formerly of the Doobie Brothers.
Formerly of the Doobie Brothers. And
this was the pop version of smooth jazz.
Exactly. I guess you could say that, or the rock version, yeah.
I wouldn't say that.
No, it doesn't really rock.
I would not
no.
say that. All right. So that's kind of some of the source material for this. So the surprise here is not that the song becomes a hit. The surprise is that there's a song, a hip-hop song, built on this most unlikely of foundations.
That's right. It's built on a number four hit from 1982 called I Keep Forgettin' by Michael McDonald, which is a slow jam. I mean, it's basically, you know, a boudoir song that, you know, McDonald sings very smoothly. And it formed the basis of Regulate by Warren G featuring Nate Dogg, which was a number two hit in the summer of 1994, actually outcharting the original McDonald cut, which only peaked at number four.
Let's hear it. Michael McDonald from the song I Keep Forgettin', which reached number four in 1982 when he released it. And then, Chris, Warren G and Nate Dogg get hold of it, and they do better with it as a sample than he did with the original.
That's right.
Let's hear it.
So I hooked select on 2-1 and Lewis, some brothers shooting dice. So I said, let's do this. I jumped out the rock and said, what's up? Some brothers put some gas. So I said, I'm stuck.
These girls peeping me, I'm on glide and swerve. These hookers looking so hard, they straight hit the curve. Want to bigger, better things than some horny tricks. I see my homie and some suckers all in his mix.
I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I can't believe they taken Warren 12. They took my rings, they took my Rolex. I looked at the brother, said, damn, what's next?
They got my homie hemmed up and they all around. Can't none of them see him if they going straight down for pound. They want to come up real quick before they start to clown. I best pull out my strap and lay them busters down.
They got guns to my head, I think I'm going down. I can't believe it's happening in my own town.
If I had wings, I would fly. Let me contemplate. I glance in the cut and I see my homie.
He can't believe he's getting jacked in his own hometown.
That's right. Warren had a rough day. Ice Cube thought he had a tough day. Warren had a rough day.
So there's the Michael McDonald Yacht Rock sample.
Right.
It's not a particularly hardcore hip-hop sound, is it?
No, it isn't. It's extremely smooth, and that was Warren G's stock and trade. In all seriousness, the other reason we're talking about this song is it shows the power and influence of Dr. Dre in this period. Dr. Dre is actually Warren G's half-brother, half-stepbrother, to be exact. It's complicated, but Dre's mother remarried, and one of the children she inherited as a stepchild was Warren. And that's how Andre Young, Dr. Dre, got to know Warren Griffith III, who became Warren G. And Dre, of course, had a huge 1993 with his album The Chronic. He'd spun off three big hits from that. One of them, by the way, Let Me Ride, is sampled a bit in the Warren G song, so there's a callback to Dre there.
She said my chords broke down and just sing real nice with your let me ride.
And, you know, Nate Dogg and Warren and Snoop Doggy Dogg, as he was then known, were all part of the constellation of friends of Andre Young, a.k.a. Dr. Dre, in Long Beach, California. The LBC is referenced in the song by Nate Dogg. And that's how they all became, you know, rap stars in their own right. Famously, Snoop Dogg was discovered by Dre, brought in on The Chronic. Nate Dogg had also sung on The Chronic. And then, you know, in comes Warren G. And he's kind of the, if you will, smoother, even nerdier alternative to his half-brother, basically.
So what is the, I mean, there's a video, for folks who haven't seen the video,
right?
It pretty literally follows the story of the song, which is what?
Well, so what regulate means, you know, to regulate is basically to exact justice or seek revenge after getting jacked, which, as we heard in the song, is what happened to Warren. I can't believe this happened to me in my own town.
So Warren is surrounded by a bunch of young toughs, and Nate Dogg sees him and is packing some heat. As he says in one of the lines, I'm going to make some bodies go cold.
That's right.
16 in the clip and one in the hole. Nate Dogg is about to make some bodies turn cold. Now they dropping and yelling. It's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate.
Yeah, so,
and says it in this light. I mean, if you're not paying attention to the words, it sounds like such a
It's pleasant. It's extremely smooth. Yeah, exactly. But it's basically a song about exacting revenge on the guys who jacked you earlier in the day.
But that's not the end of the song.
Right.
This is what happens post-regulation.
I laid all them busters down, I let my gad explode. Now I'm switching my mind back into freak mode. If you won't skirt, sit back and observe. I just left a gang of hoes over there on the curb.
Now they got the freaks, and that's a known fact. Before I got jacked, I was on the same track. Back up, cause it's on N-A-T-E and me, the woman to the G.
Just like I thought, they were in the same spot, in need of some desperate help. But Nate Dogg and the G-Child were in need of something. One of them names was sexy as hell. I said, ooh, I like your size. She said my chords broke down and just sing real nice. Would you let me ride? I got a car full of girls and it's going real swell. The next stop is the East Side Motel.
So that, too, is regulation, apparently.
Folks, John was laughing hysterically during that entire segment.
I'm switching my mind back to freak mode.
Yeah.
Having just busted, like, you know, a dozen people out on the street corner, I'm now going to go get me some of those girls that I noticed on my way over here.
It's as if Warren and Nate thought, this may be our only hit. Let's pack in, like, you know, the feel of a smooth ballad and, you know, a story song with, you know, gangsta elements, and then let's end with, like, you know, the freaky part. Like, they just kind of packed it all into a four-and-a-half-minute song.
So we'll tell the hardcore story over a smooth jazz background,
right,
and then we'll do a little booty call at the end. And
pretty much.
All right. That was a hit in the summer of 1994 for Warren G. and Nate Dogg. Nate Dogg passed away a couple of years back.
He did, yeah, sadly, but not before having an incredible career basically kicked off by this song that made him the go-to, hip-hop hook vocalist.
Singer,
singer for the next 10 years. One of his last big hits was a song in 2003 by 50 Cent called 21 Questions, and he sings the hook on that.
And what about Warren G?
Warren G did quite well for himself, considering that he was basically in his half-brother shadow. He scored several more hits. He had another top 10 hit with This DJ. He was scoring gold albums as late as 1999. And actually, probably the most poetic thing is that a crew that had formed before they all became famous, Snoop, Warren G, and Nate Dogg, called 213. They existed back in 1990. They reformed in 2004 and had a top 10 album. So Warren had an okay little career for a guy who's basically best remembered for one big hit in the summer of 94.
And that big hit built on a sample of Michael McDonald. Do we know what McDonald thought of the use of his music this way?
I find that Michael McDonald has a pretty good sense of humor about all the ways in which his music is used. So I imagine that he was pretty tickled pink by the whole thing.
Well, especially when those checks started rolling in, I would think.
You'd think that, right?
All right. Chris Malanfi is a pop chart analyst and contributor to NPR Music and Slate and frequently appears with us on Soundcheck. Chris, good to see you.
Great seeing you, John.
Why don't everybody raise their glass to Nate Dogg? That's right. I'm going to do this one for Nate Dogg. Brenda B's going to kick it off right here. Come on, man.
White moon, but if he was on the streets trying to consume some skirts for the eve so I could get some pulling them up beside and chilling all alone.
Just hit the east side of the LBC on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G's. Call for the girls, ain't no need to tweak, so you girls know what's up with 213.
So I hooks a left on 21 and Lewis. Some brothers shooting dice, so I said, let's do this. Jumped out my ride and I said, what's up? I see the brothers pull the gas, so I'm stuck.
Since the girls tipping me, I'ma glide and swerve. These niggas looking so hard, they shrink at the curve. Bought a finger better things and some horny tricks. See my homie and some suckers all in his mix.
That's the jam band Umphrey's McGee and their live cover version of Regulate. Remember, during our Summer of 94 series this month, we want to hear from you. What were you doing in the summer of 94, and what were you listening to 20 years ago? Post your response at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. You may find your message on the air. With her group Dum Dum Girls, singer and songwriter Dee Dee Penny combines two staples of American music, 60s girl groups and sleek 80s pop. Up next, Dum Dum Girls perform songs from their recent album Too True here in our studio. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Dum Dum Girls began as a vehicle for singer and songwriter Dee Dee Penny's creations. Over the course of three full-length records and several EPs, the Dum Dum Girls, now a band, have stripped back and polished their early fuzzed-out sound. Their latest record is called Too True, and the band is here to play some of those songs for us in the studio today. Dum Dum Girls are going to start us off with a live version of Are You Okay? Here in the Soundcheck studio. That's Dum Dum Girls, live on Soundcheck with the song Are You Okay?, which you'll find on their latest album called Too True. Let me introduce you to the Dum Dum Girls, Dee Dee on vocals and guitar, Jules on guitar and backing vocals, Malia on bass and backing vocals, Sandy behind our drum kit, more backing vocals, and a Dum Dum boy joining the band, Andrew on guitar. Dee Dee, to you and the rest of the Dum Dum Girls, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So I have to assume you know the song Dum Dum Boys by Iggy Pop.
Yes.
Was that kind of the inspiration for the name of this band?
Partly, yeah. It was sort of a combination of that and the Vaseline's record, Dum Dum, unintentionally, the Talk Talk song, Dum Dum Girls.
All right.
A whole host of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, this song you just played for us, Are You Okay? You told the Boston Globe last week that this was a song you were sort of prepared to give this to Ronnie Spector to sing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a done deal or anything, mm-hmm. but I had her in mind when I was writing it because we had met a while ago and talked about maybe doing some stuff together.
Uh-huh. Have you done that before, written songs for other people to sing?
Not really. It's a new interest of mine.
Uh-huh.
But it definitely informed the chorus of the song. You know, I imagined her doing her classic sort of hiccup, you know, eh-eh.
it does have a kind of classic 60s sound to it. The vocals on this record are much more front and center than they have been in the past. Was that in the songwriting process, or was that something that happened in the making of the record?
I mean, that's always a production decision. I've been moving toward that since probably the second release on Sub Pop. I Will Be was definitely, you know, the vocal mix was much, much lower. But after that record, when I started working in actual studios with Richard Goddard and my engineer, Alonzo, you know, they've been slowly coaxing me.
Now, talking about that classic 60s sound, you know, you're working with Richard Goddard, who wrote I Want Candy,
yeah.
and My Boyfriend's Back, and a whole host
all
of
sorts.
Yeah. So that kind of DNA is it in the material when you write it, or does that happen in the studio with?
I definitely have always looked towards sort of the 60s era of songwriting as my model. I would say I felt like such, you know, simple, streamlined pop songs came out of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was learning to write songs, I was learning to play a lot of those songs, which made writing my own stuff accessible. You know, like, oh, okay, I can see how this song, which is an amazing song, breaks down into three chords, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was inspiring. And, yeah, we definitely speak the same language, I think.
Yeah. So there's the 60s thing. There's also a kind of jangly 80s guitar-y sound to a lot of this new record, especially.
Definitely.
I know you're a Smiths fan. You covered There Is a Light That Never Goes Out at one point.
Yes.
Have you read the Morrissey autobiography yet?
I've started it.
You've
yeah.
started it?
Yeah.
How far in are you?
I'm about a third of the way, I'd say.
Okay.
It's on my floor in my bedroom.
our executive producer, Joel Meyer, put together this Morrissey book club where he was going to get staff and our listeners to read along with him.
That's awesome.
And I think a lot of people stayed with him for the first third of the book, and then they started dropping like flies.
Oh, no. I feel like it's getting better.
Okay. Well, what's your favorite part so far?
Well, I have always appreciated his outspokenness towards animal rights. So I've unintentionally gone back to being vegan since starting the book.
Wow.
So
that seems like a hard thing to do unintentionally.
Well, I've been vegan in the past, and I've, you know, run the whole gamut of the diet thing, but I just couldn't keep reading it and not. It sunk in again.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Meat is murder, as they famously said on one of their records. Now, so you write the songs. At what point do they become band things? I mean, do they begin as girl with a guitar in a bedroom?
I've always written pretty much that way. This record, I wrote all the songs at one point, you know, like in a condensed situation. Usually I kind of write them over a period of time. And this time around, I also wrote them and recorded them electric instead of, you know, on my acoustic guitar, which is how I normally do things. Everything was just a little more accelerated for this one. And then we get together and rehearse and then go on tour. So it kind of has two forms, you know. It's like a recorded thing, and then we run it through the live filter.
So you road test them before you actually make the final version.
Yeah, I get to go to L.A. for like a vacation because they all live in L.A. And then
you're here in New York.
There, yeah.
Right. We're speaking with Dee Dee and the Dum Dum Girls here in the Soundcheck studio. The newest album from the band is Too True. It's out now. This is one of my favorite songs off the record, In the Wake of You. You want to do that for us next?
We'd love to.
All right. It's Dum Dum Girls live on Soundcheck. Live music from Dum Dum Girls here in the Soundcheck studio. In the Wake of You is from their latest album called Too True, but that's a live version the band played for us here on Soundcheck today. This next song actually goes back to an earlier record, the 2011 collection called Only in Dreams. Here's Dum Dum Girls with Coming Down.
I can get
That's lovely. Dum Dum Girls, live on Soundcheck with Coming Down, which is not off the new record, Too True. It's from 2011's Only in Dreams. Dee Dee, we were talking before about, you know, sort of the sound of the band progressing from album to album. What happens to these songs when you go back 3 years and a couple of records? And do the songs change then?
Yeah, they typically do. Everything kind of starts to move forward. It's fun to play songs off the first record, sort of with the coloring that we're doing the new songs in, although there can be quite a discrepancy between the initial energy of a song. But something like Coming Down, we used to do all the time, and we stopped doing it because I was having so much vocal difficulty, and so we just started doing it again, and at least for me, it feels really great.
By vocal difficulty, you mean like nodes on the
vocal
cords?
Yeah, I had just kind of thrashed my voice and had to take a lot of time off. So this song in particular was a nightmare. so it feels really special that we can play it again.
That's great.
Yeah.
So now that you are back in business, you clearly do mean business because there's another record coming out, right? Your husband is the lead singer of Crocodiles.
Yes.
And the two of you are finally doing a record together.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny to be in the whirlwind of this tour and then be reminded, oh, right, the single came out
yesterday. Oh, that.
yeah, that's something we've been meaning to do forever. Obviously, we both play music, and it'd be strange if we avoided collaborating any longer at this point. But it was nice. We were able to write the record during said off time, and it's a cool thing to have, you know. In 20 years, assuming we don't hate each other, you know, we'll have this cute little time capsule of when we were young.
And the name is Haunted Hearts.
Yeah.
The album will be called Initiation. But in the meantime, we have Too True, the latest from Dum Dum Girls, who are touring around, playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. And Dee Dee to you, and again, the rest of the Dum Dum Girls. This has been fun. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
The void in my head, the hole in my heart, I fill them with things which all fall apart.
With her big voice and fiery stage presence, Sharon Jones seems invincible. But her battle with cancer caused some fans to wonder if she might just be a mere mortal after all. Well, that turned out to be silly thinking. The soul singer and frontwoman of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings tells us about her recovery and her latest album called Give the People What They Want. Plus, Anne DeLisi of our public radio sister station WDET in Detroit joins us with three picks from the summer of 94 as part of our ongoing retrospective. So that's coming up tomorrow, but that'll do it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.